This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The headline in yesterday's Charlotte Observer read, Charlotte immigrants' stories have one thing in common these days, fear. And that's the story across the country during these dawning days of the Trump administration. It started with the president's executive order restricting immigration and banning the arrival of refugees for 120 days. That order was quickly stayed by the courts, but shortly thereafter, ICE, the Federal Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agency, began a series of arrests. This past Monday, federal officials announced the arrest of more than 100 undocumented immigrants in the Carolinas, with a similar number occurring in other areas of the nation. Those specific charges were not detailed for the 84 immigrants arrested in this state and the 19 in South Carolina. ICE says it is targeting criminals. Still, that has raised the level of fear in the immigrant community, even among those who are documented. Though Charlotte is not a sanctuary city, we haven't been aggressive in finding and rounding up undocumented immigrants, and CMPD has had a longstanding policy not to ask about a person's status in the course of normal interactions. We wanted to know more about that policy, and so we've invited Chief Kerr Putney to rejoin us on the program to talk about that and about some other issues as well. And later in the program, we will further explore the impact on Charlotte's immigrant community due to policies enacted by the Trump administration. Chief Putney, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thank you for the invitation.
Let me hear from you, in your words, what CMPD's policy is on interactions with anybody that you come in contact with.
Yes, sir. Well, 2015, the end of 2015, the legislation in the state came out saying that we could not prohibit our officers from asking immigration status or from sharing that information with federal authorities. So up until that point, we prohibited it. So we pulled that out of our policy, and now we're in line with the state law, which is in line with federal law. So we can't prohibit our officers from asking for the immigration status. However, our practice and our philosophy is we're trying to connect with all communities. Therefore, the request, the inquiry, isn't really relevant to us because it is the federal government's job. It's ICE's job to do that work. We do partner with our federal government when we make cases on violent criminals, and some of which, after conviction and they go to jail, they are deported. That is about the extent of it. So I tell everybody, if you're not committing crimes in our jurisdiction, you're not going to have an issue with us around your immigration status.
And the mayor has said we're not a sanctuary city. You have just said that you're in line with federal and state law on this topic, and yet in the paper this morning, and I think we've been reporting it as well, the big headline today in the paper was that Charlotte Mayor Roberts may have put our city in jeopardy of losing $20 million in funding because of comments that she made that give the illusion that we are not in compliance with at least state law, and there's no love lost between Raleigh and Charlotte. They're looking for reasons to cut us, it seems to me. So you're saying that we are right to the letter following the state law?
Yes, we are. The legislation on the state or federal level does not compel us to inquire about immigration status. Therefore, we do not. If we were compelled, it'd be a different story. And the other thing, Mike, is I'm not here to thumb my nose at the federal government. Many of the federal agencies are very good partners of ours, which help us improve the safety and maintain safety in our city. However, the confusion is around what our role is in enforcing those immigration laws, and we don't have one.
Well, when it comes to other federal laws that you may or may not get involved with at the local level, what are they? I mean, is this an exception?
We don't enforce internal revenue laws. We don't enforce most of the federal laws because that is outside of our purview. We do partner with the federal agencies because they can indeed take those to the federal level for prosecution, and we do that quite often with violent crimes of gang violence and terrorism, to be quite frank with you. We don't have those authorities, so we partner with them to do that work.
So let's break it down to a very low level here. So there's no lack of understanding because there is this fear running
in the
immigrant community. When you stop somebody for a traffic violation or a broken taillight or something, and you're just pulling the person over to say, hey, you got a broken taillight, you need to get that fixed, you don't ask them what their immigration status is. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's irrelevant
to us. But an officer can, if they want to, ask them.
Per state law, yes.
Okay. If you break a bar fight or intervene in a domestic dispute, you don't ask them about their immigration status, but an officer could if they wanted to. If they do, do you have to answer truthfully?
That is going to be up to that individual. And I always encourage people to be truthful.
Okay.
Because lying to an officer is indeed a crime.
So if you are asked and you answer truthfully and you are undocumented, what then?
That's the big question. What then? Our role, again, is to fight crime. So if you're not involved in a crime.
But isn't that a crime?
Is what a crime?
Being here undocumented.
It is against federal law, yes. So what would happen if we're let's just use another example. We're indiscriminately stopping people, and I stop you and ask you for your immigration status. It's a voluntary contact. You don't have to say anything to me, but if you do tell me your immigration status, then as an officer, I determine the next steps. What we tell our people is it's not relevant to us unless you're committing a crime. And if you're a victim of crime, we don't care about your immigration status then. What we care about is solving that crime and bringing the people who've committed that crime to justice. So therein lies our issue, Mike. It is very confusing because people believe that we're here to enforce immigration laws.
Well, it's not policy because it can't be policy. Therefore, every person walking the street is political. They have politics.
Yes, they do.
At their root, how confident are you that police officers are really not asking the question?
Because I don't see a lot of evidence that they're locking people up indiscriminately who are, the example was a tail light and. That is not what we're locking people up for. We're locking people up for crimes. If you're breaking into other people's houses, that's a criminal act.
Okay, and when you apprehend somebody who's breaking into a house or somebody who's shot somebody else, whether the person is injured or dies,
absolutely.
Do you then ask what their immigration status is?
As a practice, no. We take you you to the Mecklenburg County Jail, and 287G attaches at that point, and then ICE gets involved to determine whether or not you'll be deported.
287G is something that the Sheriff's Department takes a role in. This is a government program to detain undocumented immigrants, and the Sheriff's Department enforces that. Why do they enforce cooperating with the federal government, and yet CMPD does not?
It's a voluntary program, and our sheriff has determined that. And the sheriff before him determined that that was a program they wanted to be a part of. Therefore, they opted in.
Okay. The president has said that Mexico is sending us their worst. He said he calls them bad hombres, and he's called them rapists, and he's called them murderers. From your experience in Charlotte, is that statement true?
Well, Mike, that's a broad statement. And again, I'm not here thumbing my nose at the president or the federal government, but my experience, I told you, I did an immersion in Mexico. I am struggling to try to learn the language and have been for quite some time. But I have an appreciation for the culture. I'm not going to make a broad statement on anybody, regardless of where you're from. And I see that as being the same when you talk about Mexico or any other country.
But statistically, in Charlotte, among the people who have come into contact with police officers, either because they've been caught in the commission of a crime or apprehended because of a previous crime, are these people bad hombres, or are they just people?
I don't have any data that shows me Mexicans are arrested at a higher rate than any other immigrants that we might have in this jurisdiction. So I'm not arguing the point. All I'm saying is I don't see evidence that would back that up here.
What is the percentage of people who are arrested for committing crimes who are either immigrants or undocumented immigrants?
I don't have that data. You'd have to request that through ICE. We don't track data in that manner.
Okay. You said that your primary goal is to prevent and solve crimes, so it is critical to maintain trust between your department and all communities in Charlotte. And even the federal government has this effort to fight terrorism called If You See Something, Say Something.
Yes.
I take it that your argument is that if people cannot trust the law enforcement people that they will be reporting something that they see to, they won't.
We see that all the time, Mike. If there is no trust, and in some of our communities, Latino communities and some of our black communities, if they don't have a high level of trust of us, they're not going to report things to us that they see, criminal or otherwise.
So, sure. So because you don't go out of your way to ask people their status when you have encounters with them, have you been able to build that trust? What's the result of your approach, I guess, is the question.
We have built quite a bit of trust. I was just a couple months ago at an event that is hosted by Our Lady of Guadalupe, mm-hmm. attended by about 300 Latinos, and we had a great conversation. We continue to do a lot of outreach there. So, yes, we struggle because anytime you feel somebody is intent on randomly taking your freedom, they're going to be suspicious of you. So we struggle. But, yes, we're making some headway.
So in the last couple of weeks, we've heard news reports of a rise in fear in the immigrant community because of the ban, the immigrant and refugee ban, which is currently on a temporary hold at the court level, and also the rise in ICE activity and arrests. How does that affect you when ICE is out there arresting people at the federal level? Because you're all wearing badges.
Sure.
How does that affect you? Well, and your ability to communicate with these folks.
Again, people who are reasonable are having a conversation and they understand the difference. Again, if you're committing crimes, you're putting yourself at peril, you're putting your ability to live here in peril. And we tell people, if you're a victim of crime, our job is to solve that crime. If you're committing a crime, our job is to bring you to justice. And by bringing you to justice, if 287G attaches, that is where the immigration piece of the puzzle is affected.
We'll talk a lot more about this later in the program, but I guess I would imagine that some officers in your force have relationships with people in the immigrant community because of your approach to this thus far. So are you hearing stories of people telling officers of their fear and what they're afraid of and how
Absolutely.
It's impacted the community?
Absolutely. Hearing? We're hearing a lot of fear. We're also hearing, though, that there have been some false stories created by people who want to, you know, continue to stir up that fear. But we're hearing legitimate fear from people who are worried about the status of their parents. And they're thinking that the application of the immigration, the enforcement of the immigration laws will, tear their family apart.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do is just what I'm telling you. We're trying to make sure they understand that is not our role. Our job is to continue to make sure the city's safe and all community members are safe as well.
There isn't just fear. There is anger in this community, and several groups got together last Friday and called on police and other city officials to protect them from what they view as a war on immigrant families. Can you do that? Will you do that?
Protect against the law? I'm sorry, that's not quite what we're here for. I'm not here to help anybody violate the law. What I'm telling you is the way the law works. If you're not committing crimes, 287G doesn't attach, and you have a lot less to fear. If you are committing crimes, then it very well could.
Mecklenburg County Commissioner Bill James wants Charlotte to ask the Justice Department if the city is complying with the president's executive order, and he worries that CMPD's – and he's not alone. Other people have come out about this. He worries that CMPD's policy of not asking people about their immigration status could jeopardize federal funds for the city. You're confident? You've talked to the city attorney, the county attorney about this?
I have no worries along those lines. We're doing our job within the boundaries of law. I stand behind them. I believe in them, and we're going to conduct business as we have been.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Chief Kerr Putney from Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department in a moment. We'll talk about a little bit more about immigration and some other issues as well. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of the Carolinas healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. And Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. Former Mecklenburg County Manager Harry Jones loses his battle with cancer. Charlotte immigrants are nervous in the face of ICE arrests. Governor Cooper strikes out with his HB2 compromise. Those stories and more on the local news roundup on this program tomorrow at 9. And I want to remind you to save the date. WFAE is planning a public conversation to talk about immigration policy enforcement and its impact on the immigrant community in Charlotte. It will be Tuesday night, February 28th. We'll have details about where and what time later on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, tax reform and your shopping cart. American retailers, importers are warning of big price hikes. American exporters are ready to celebrate. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That's coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Chief Kerr Putney from CNPD is with us. We've just talked a lot about immigrants. We'll talk some more about immigrants and the anger and frustration and fear in that community with some other folks a little bit later on in the program. But I only have you to 9:30, and I want to cover some more territory here.
Yes, sir.
After years of a nationwide decline in the crime rate, there has been a slight uptick, and the same is true here in Charlotte. Homicides, I think we're up 16.7%. Last year, assaults up 11.4%. Robberies saw an 8.9% increase. Vehicle thefts, my gosh, rose 24.4%. Do you understand what's going on?
Well, it's a complex issue, but what I can tell you from my perspective is after 10 to 15 years of decline, we're seeing that trend kind of take the opposite turn on us. What we've done is ask for more officers, but what we're also looking at, though, is specific ways we can prevent some of these crimes from occurring. As far as our car thefts and larcenies from auto, what we're telling people is if someone comes by your car and can see valuables in it, there's a high likelihood they're going to steal them. Mm-hmm. We want you to lock your doors, but we also want you to take your valuables out. The violent crime is what's really bothering us, though. Issue with gun violence is a serious issue across the country and here locally. We have too many people that want to settle minor disputes with a firearm. So we're focused on our priority offenders that we see who continue to engage in gun violence. If I'm willing to point a gun at you or shoot into a house that's occupied,
right,
I'm much more likely to commit a homicide. So those are the kinds of people we're really focusing on as we see those kinds of crimes occur around the jurisdiction.
There was a newspaper carrier shot and killed, I think it was
West. Yes, sir.
It seemed to be random. What do you know about that?
Yes. Right now what we know is the intent appears to be robbery. What we also know is the issue we were struggling with, and Wes is well known to many of us who've worked uptown, is it touches people who we think are going about their business in a everyday way, not really engaging in risky behavior. Those are the kinds that really strike you, and it's like a punch to the gut. So we doubled down, really trying to find out exactly what's going on. We're looking to make additional cases that are in that area. But right now, I'm just happy that we were able to find out exactly what occurred in that particular case.
You've asked in the past for more police officers, and I think you got half of what you asked for. And I would think that you're probably going to be asking again in the future. Because
yes, sir. You know the math. Yes, sir.
Because we're under-policed for the size of the city that we are, and
yes,
we're growing quickly. And
we are.
But I guess my question is, you could not have more police would not have prevented that shooting.
Unfortunately, no. But what I see is, if we're more proactive, if we're more visible, we can deter. What we can't measure, Mike, is what we prevent. But I know, because I've seen over the last 8 years even, the more we have at our disposal working the way we do, we can avoid some of those consequences. Not all, but a lot more, hopefully.
You've identified four areas that have been experiencing higher than normal rates of violent crime, and they are Central Avenue, East and Eastway Drive, the Plaza and Eastway, Milton Road and Sharon Amity, and Sugar Creek I-85 corridor.
Yes, sir.
Why tell people where you're going to put more officers to fight crime? Why tell them that?
I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. If you're there to commit crimes, you might want to choose a different city, hopefully.
But doesn't that run the risk of them saying, well, we can't go there, so we'll go over here?
Displacement is effective. Right now what we see is if they generally aggregate in a certain area, we're going to disrupt that practice, that behavior. And what I'll also let you know is the more we can keep people off their routine, mm-hmm. the less likely they will commit crimes.
Last year's riots following Keith Lamont Scott's shooting by police resulted in calls for more transparency. At the same time, the state law changed with regard to how you can get access to body and dash cam footage, which kind of ties your hands in many cases. But put a video aside, nearly 3 weeks after, is it Jesu Javier Diaz?
Yes.
Diaz was fatally shot by police. CMPD has refused to identify the officer, even to the family. Is that because he was working undercover?
That's precisely why.
Okay.
We do not release the name of an officer who's working undercover because it could jeopardize not only the safety of the officer, which is paramount, but also the many cases that have yet to be prosecuted.
But then how do people working on behalf of the victim find out whether this was a random act or whether this is part of a pattern of behavior on the part of that officer?
Well, that's the whole point of on the behalf of the officer.
Yes.
Well,
there's a big lack of trust about how police interact with people.
Here's what I can tell you, Mike. What's interesting is a lot of people say that. But I think the majority of the citizens of this city do have quite a bit of trust for us as an organization, and it's proven in every study that we do annually. Do we see a decrease in certain segments? Sure. But what we're trying to do is more outreach. But I'll tell you, we have to allow the process to work, the fact-finding to continue, and then the district attorney will present all of the facts so that everybody can see exactly what we know, when we knew it, and make their own determination after he's made his adjudication.
Because there is some conflicting information here with regard to the police say one thing and an eyewitness says another. That will eventually come out in the wash?
Absolutely. Any inconsistencies in statements will be readily apparent when the district attorney reviews and covers all that information.
Was this captured in any way by police dash or body cams?
No. Undercover officers do not have body-worn cameras. That would, again, jeopardize
that would
their
off. Well, yeah, what
safety.
What about the cars? Because cameras are tiny now.
Yeah, dash cams. That was another issue for us. Dash cams, the technology is obsolete, so we're looking at new versions of it. We have yet to find one that is actually going to give us what we need, so that is a part of it. But we generally don't have dash cams in our undercover vehicles either.
Police-wide, department-wide, you are pushing for more dash cams. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I am. Once we can determine what that technology needs to be, because technology changes so fast. And I'll also say this, Mike. We can put cameras all over the city if we want to. And we act as though that's going to capture everything and increase trust. I can tell you, from having done this job when cameras did not exist, ultimately the justice system is set up to be based on the facts. And a camera can't always give you all angles to definitively show everybody who sees that footage the true facts.
It's not a multiple camera shoot TV show.
Nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
Yes, nothing is perfect.
How much would it take? How much money would it take to outfit all of the patrol cars with dash cams?
That's yet to be determined. I'm sure it's going to be sticker shock because the technology is emerging, but don't really know exactly what that's going to look like right now.
And body cams, because they're not broadcast television steady cams.
Right.
Don't always show you what the officers see because they're jiggling around. They're not necessarily placed exactly where they need to be for that particular shot that you're trying to see. So are you looking for ways to anchor body cams in a better way so that we see a better field of view?
We absolutely are. We have them on the shoulder or the head, but again, it depends on what you're looking at and where you're pointed at the time. So we're looking at center mass on the officers as well. We're testing some of those. We believe it is a steadier version. But again, no camera angle that we can create is going to be perfect.
Do you think you're making headway in building trust, particularly within the African-American community, not just because of acts that have taken place between the police department here and the African-American, but all over the country this is a problem? Are you making headway, do you think?
Well, I do believe so, yes. Some of the very people who are protesting are now doing great work, collaborating with us.
Okay.
They're showing us some blind spots that we didn't even realize we had. They're stepping out and, sometimes even fighting a false narrative. But they're also seeing on a deeper level that we are just like the community that we police. We're human. We're imperfect. But for the most part, we have our hearts in the right place. We're not intentionally trying to do anybody harm. Nobody likes to hear it, but I'm going to continue to say it. If you cooperate and communicate, you'll allow us to de-escalate a lot of these volatile situations. Out of 71 SWAT deployments, only 69 of them were resolved without us firing around. So, yes, I think we are getting better. We got a lot more work to do, Mike.
Do you think you're more transparent?
Yes, I do. Transparency workshops are going on all the time. And here's the thing. If you want me to be irresponsibly transparent, meaning give you everything when you want it, how you want it, just because you want it, because you think that's going to change most hearts and minds, most of the people right now believe in what we're trying to do and believe in the way we're trying to do it. So, yes, I think we're a transparent organization. I think anyone can compare us to any other organization across the country, and you'd see we fare fairly well.
Chief Kirk Putney, the Chief of Police here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate
Always.
It.
Thank you, sir.
Come back. The fear and uncertainty in the immigrant community has been rising by the day since President Trump took office. Whether you agree with the president's approach or not, you cannot deny the fear these people feel because they see themselves as being targeted. WFAE's David Borax has been covering this story, and he joins us for the remainder of the hour, along with Alan Gordon, an immigration attorney in Charlotte. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you. Good to be back.
And Atenas Borola is also with us. She is director and managing attorney at the Immigrant Integration Center, part of the Latin American Coalition. Good morning and welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. David, how would you describe what's been going on in Charlotte's immigrant community since Donald Trump's issue of his executive order on immigrants and refugees?
Well, Mike, I think there's a great deal of uncertainty, fear, anger. Really, people are trying to figure out what it means for them now that the Trump administration is in office and has put out an order that basically changes U.S. policy towards immigrants here.
Atenas, you say that fear is being felt not just among undocumented immigrants, but among all immigrants. Why?
Because there's collateral damage for everything. And the other thing is that the executive order doesn't just target undocumented immigrants. It can also target immigrants who have some form of status, even lawful permanent residence. But it also targets, or it affects rather, the children of undocumented immigrants, the U.S.-born children of undocumented immigrants, other family members, and really all people of color who are now afraid once again of a federal agency more so than usual.
How can it target the children of undocumented who were born in this country?
It doesn't target, it affects them.
Okay. Because their parents might get deported and they're here
right.
as their citizens. How much more work have you seen, Alan and Atenas, in your two offices since this began in the last, I guess, 3 weeks?
Well, what we've been seeing is not so much work as we've gotten lots of calls. People come in for a meeting and they're telling us they're reporting what's going on in their community, what happened to their friends, what they think happened to their friends, or in other cities. So there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of misunderstanding. We always ask the question, well, was this person under an order of deportation? Because lots of people, tens of thousands of people have been ordered deported, and then they allowed them to stay here. They gave them work permission. They said, come on in and check in every month and show us that you're still around, and we'll let you continue to work and support your family. So the executive order threw all that up in the air, and what I'd say is in the old days under Obama – he deported over 400,000 people in one fiscal year, and that was a lot more than ever before if you added all the Bushes together.
Well, so he's been called the deporter-in-chief by some. So why is this different? How is this different?
I think it's different because if you read the executive order, it goes well beyond what the previous priorities were. Those were violent criminals, drug dealers, and
Recent entries,
well, in the old days.
Pre-Obama?
Yeah, well.
Under Obama, recent entries were a priority, right, which is where a lot of his numbers came from.
Right. I think, so he got to the recent entries. But Now it's wide open. It's like anybody that's – if we've got suspicion that you've violated a law, we're not even saying what kind of law, then you can be detained.
And let me clarify a little bit. So Obama kind of went in two directions. Early on, he was deporting people. He did have 400,000 in 2012. But after 2012, he changed his tune a bit, and it was more looking at the what might be considered high risk or criminals and that sort of thing. And he kind of took it easy on people who were here with families who were not violating any laws. And it was partly a manpower thing. You know, it's easier to focus on one group than to kind of do a blanket enforcement as we're seeing now. And I think that's going to be an issue for the Trump administration.
But candidate Trump did not hide his intentions in this area. He's just following through on what he said he would do. Why has this come as such a shock to the immigrant community? Didn't they see this coming? They didn't think he would do it?
I think people didn't believe that he would.
Why? That's why he got elected.
Yeah, I can't say, but it's not just the shock that is for the immigrant community. Maybe people were expecting, you know, we've been saying since he got elected, okay, we have to start expecting the worst. We hope it won't happen, but we have to start it. The thing is, though, that the communities are being terrorized, and that is what's more important and what's affecting
us. I think it's pretty simple, Mike, actually. The rules were one thing, and now after 3 weeks ago, they've changed. And people who were following the rules, even if they were here without documentation, they were following the rules at the time, and now it's changed.
And we'll talk about that, because following the rules now might get you deported. But it's the terrorization that you refer to, Atenas. Mm-hmm. Is it more on the executive order, which is now in limbo at the moment because of court stays, or is it the fact that ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, has been out rounding up people around the country?
Well, so there were three executive orders, and only one of them is currently on hold. From the one that affects our communities, and the reason that ICE has done these increased actions is because another one of the executive orders broadened the priority, as Alan was saying, so that almost anyone who is undocumented is now a priority and is now a target for ICE. So yes, it is because of the increased ICE action, but that directly relates back to one of the executive orders.
David, there were reports that ICE has been terrorizing Charlotte's east side, not just from Atenas, from other sources as well, which is where a lot of immigrants live in Charlotte on the east side. These reports were spread in many cases by social media. ICE insists those reports were wrong. Who's right? Have these rumors been debunked?
Well, there were on social media, there were a lot of claims about things that were happening, and it's hard for us as reporters to get at whether that happened or not. You know, people are saying they did things at schools, that they were stopping people in places where they haven't done that in the past. And I, you know, unable to confirm that as a reporter. We do have ICE saying that, you know, we are following the protocols that we've always followed, and we don't do it near those locations.
Well, federal officials say they haven't been doing anything different in the last 2 weeks. Do you think that is true?
But,
is it the same number of arrests as before this?
We also have them saying that, and we've learned since that, in fact, there is something going on here. And so I think it's hard to completely trust ICE in its what it's saying about this.
Anecdotally, we are hearing that many immigrants are afraid to go out of their houses. They don't want to drive their kids to school. They have other people driving them to school. We have people worrying about sending their children to school because of this. They're afraid to go to work. They're afraid to go to the grocery stores. Are those fears unfounded?
As far as what we've seen and what we've heard, and we watch social media as well, but when we finally get a case that we can follow down, follow back on, then we're finding that, well, somebody had a conviction of something like spousal abuse or domestic violence. So, you know, we're finding connections.
And they wouldn't have been arrested prior to Donald Trump's presidency? They would have been ignored?
I think a lot of them were arrested. I just think that now everybody's afraid.
We have to stop. We'll come back with more of this conversation in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. And Culture and Heritage Museums hosting a concert by the Suffers, a band rooted in the tradition of African-American gospel music, Saturday at the McKelvey Center. Tickets at chmuseums.org/southernsoundseries. Retailers and importers are warning of big price hikes if President Trump's tax reform talk turns into policy. So, Tom Ashbrook on Point today in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock talks about what it would mean for your wallet and your shopping cart. We're talking about immigration policy and its effect on the immigrant community here, and you can join our conversation at wfae.org/charlottetalks or charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
The story of President Trump's first 100 days is unfolding across the country.
These sorts of things that are happening right now, we have to stand up. And if we don't stand up, then it normalizes.
He's got the right idea. We've got to put our country first, not just on the pro-life issue, but with everything. We've got to get jobs back into the country.
You can count on NPR News to follow how decisions in Washington play out at home. Listen every day.
Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fear in the immigrant community because of the executive order and the executive orders that Donald Trump has put out, and also because of the ICE, the increased ICE activity around the area and around the country. Atena Spurola is with us. She's director and managing attorney for the Immigration Integration Center with the Latin American Coalition. Alan Gordon is an immigration attorney with Alan Gordon Immigration Law, and David Borax is a reporter for WFAE News, who has been covering this. And one thing that you've reported on, David, is that ICE has been going after people facing deportation orders who have been allowed to stay for various reasons and are under orders of supervision. And now they're being detained at their regular routine check-ins. So they're being penalized or threatened as they comply with the law? Is that what we're saying, you're seeing here?
Well, this is a case, this is part of the case where, you know, the rules have changed. Some of these people have been allowed to stay here under the previous Obama administration policy that said, look, if people are here, they've got family, maybe they have kids who are U.S. citizens, they've got parents who are here who are sick, they've got spouses here. And the Obama administration says, look, as long as you're obeying the law, we're not going to prioritize deportation of folks like you. And they are required to go for regular check-ins with ICE officials about this. And so they're going about it. I talked to a couple of immigration lawyers this week who said, we don't know what to tell these people now. Should they go to their appointments or not? It's kind of confusing for both the lawyers and the people who are in this situation. I mean, if you don't go for your appointment, then you've broken the rules that you were under.
So Alan and Tennis, what are you telling these folks? What are you telling them to do?
We're telling people to comply with the agreements that they made, because if they made an agreement – well, there's a whole unit for looking for absconders, looking for fugitives. So if they don't show up, they're a fugitive, then they'll go get them. Mm-hmm. If they want them to – you know, they expect them to come in as they agreed to, as they were ordered.
So this is like reporting to your parole officer.
Exactly.
Essentially.
But the new order, as Athena is going to tell you, it opens it up where you could be held in detention. Now we're supposed to put all of our legal resources to making holding detention centers, prisons across the southern border. There was no mention of Canada, by the way, in the bigger border.
And the other thing that people a lot of the times forget about immigration detention is that directly cost taxpayers money. It is taxpayers who are paying every night thousands and thousands of dollars to detain these immigrants who up until now were complying with the law and had been allowed to stay here.
I know you wanted to talk about this because I got a note saying that you were you wanted to point out the fact that the Canadian border is much larger, longer, many more miles than the southern border in the United States, and yet they're not building detention facilities along the Canadian border. But that, in truth, Canadians are not trying to sneak into the country.
But the Canadian immigration law allows lots of people from all over the world. They don't have a ban on seven nations or anything. So
Do we have any evidence that people are coming to Canada so they can get into the United States?
I think we had a
– In great numbers?
We don't have any numbers from the south as far as terrorists. We do have, I think, at least one from the north as far as terrorism.
Okay.
So that's 100% more.
And the president order does call for moving as many resources as necessary to areas along our southern border. And you say, Alan, that there are immigration court backlogs already of a year to a year and a half in many parts of the country. Moving immigration judges from existing sites to new border detention facilities would further increase those delays. So if the government starts rounding people up, does that mean they're leaving, or are they just going to be caught in this process for a year and a half, 2 years, 2.5 years, 3 years?
There'll be people that need to have a hearing and that are entitled to a hearing that will wait years to get a hearing. And if they move the judges, we have three judges in Charlotte for the two Carolinas. If they move one or two of those judges down to the southern border, then it'll go from a year, year and a half delay to probably a 4 year delay.
So will they end up in those detention camps that we've talked about before on this program that were in the southwestern part of the United States?
Well, they've been sending people that they arrest in the Carolinas down to Georgia. So there's a detention facility. It really comes down to cost. When Mecklenburg County Jail was expensive, they didn't like to use it.
How large is the immigrant community here, Athanas? Do you know?
Large. I don't know exact numbers. I know that in 2013 or 2011, there was 850,000 Latinos in North Carolina. I don't have updated numbers.
Do we have any idea the percentage who may be here without permission?
We don't know those numbers.
Let me say a little bit about these recent arrests. So we heard that there were about 190 arrests in the Carolinas and Georgia, which is this region for ICE. And, I've heard from some people, well, all these people were under deportation orders, so they should just be executed and send them back. But that's actually not the case. Only about 17 –
The orders should be executed.
The orders should be executed, right. Only about 17 of the 190 in our region were people who had previous deportation orders. And you could make an argument, well, let's just carry those out now. But that means that most of the people who've been rounded up recently are not currently subject to a deportation order, and that puts them into the boat that you just described, which is people who are going to have to go through a due process series of hearings before any order is issued. And what they're doing is they're going to have to put them in some kind of detention in most cases. Now, if you're arrested in Charlotte and you are going through the ICE process, you go to York County Detention Center first, which has a contract with ICE, and then you go somewhere else. Now, there's such a big crowd there at York right now that I heard people are – you said mentioned Georgia. I think people are being sent to Charleston as well. So we're already starting to overflow some of the facilities we have. Trump's executive order calls for building more of these.
Okay. ICE rounded up about, I think, 600 or 700 people across the country in the last week, and they include 84 in North Carolina and 19 in South Carolina. I'm not sure how many of those would be from Charlotte, Mecklenburg, but maybe one of you does.
I've heard – from a pretty reliable source that at least 30 of those were from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area.
Okay. So who are these people? What were they? Why were they rounded up? What are they expected, suspected of having done, aside from being here illegally?
ICE doesn't release that information. In the release that they gave this week, they gave three examples of very bad immigrants who committed very bad crimes. But we don't know the other 100 and however if they were for a traffic violation, if it was as,
But CMPD doesn't ask about that for traffic stops. And ICE doesn't do traffic stops.
No, but if they had a previous traffic violation. So if there is on their record a traffic violation under the new executive orders, that person can be a priority if they had a speeding ticket in the past.
I had an immigration lawyer tell me this week that they think that because the Trump administration has now made a priority of deporting illegal immigrants, that everybody is now on the table. We're talking about all 11 million people who are in the country without papers, and that right now ICE is just going for the low-hanging fruit. So if somebody is showing up for a order of supervision hearing with ICE, it's easy to get them. Let's cut them out.
You spoke last Friday about parents or guardians who were reportedly picked up at a school bus stop by ICE earlier in the week. Did that in fact happen?
So what we believe happened is that there was ICE activity near a school. I don't believe I said that it was at the school or at a bus stop, but we do believe that it was near the school. Students and teachers saw ICE. There's no way that you can say it wasn't near a school if people at the school could see it.
And ICE told me that nothing happened at the school. It was Berry Hill Academy, the one we're talking about. They said it was a mile and a half away. Now,
some great eyesight.
Yeah. I mean, the fact is that people did see this on the way to school.
The Latin American Coalition joined with the NAACP and other groups, I think, last week to issue an ultimatum. These are your words. To city and county leaders, you want them to take a public stand against the arrests on behalf of the community's immigrant population or face a backlash at the polls. What kind of response have you received? Because you're asking these folks to break the law.
We are not asking anyone to break the law. We are just asking that the city, that the school district support its immigrants and support.
How?
You know, one thing that the school district could do would say pass a resolution or just make a statement saying that ICE is not welcome at schools, at bus stops, or between home and school. Other cities in North Carolina have done something like that.
Does it have any impact whatsoever on ICE? Do they listen to that or do they just ignore it?
You know, ICE is a federal agency. They can ignore it. Right. However, public media, public relations does affect what ICE does.
You heard Chief Putney a little mm-hmm. while ago talk about the police department's approach and the fact that they had to change their approach a little bit because mm-hmm. the law changed. Are you satisfied with how CMPD conducts itself?
You know, we think CMPD is a good partner for the community right now, especially in terms of immigration enforcement. The chief has been very clear that CMPD does not enforce federal immigration laws because that is not their job. They are here to protect the community from crime, and they are doing
this. This is a very divisive issue, and on the one hand, you have people like our mayor saying, and she's not alone, saying that she doesn't believe anybody should be deported for having a broken taillight. In other words, just because they were pulled over for that violation or another violation, she's in sync with CMPD's, I don't want to call it a policy anymore, but their approach. Let's put it that way. On the other hand, you have President Trump and many people in his camp who say that if you're not here legally, you should get out or you should be put out by the scruff of your neck like a cat. Alan and Atenas, you're both lawyers. You're both sworn to uphold the law. That's the law. What's your take on this?
Well, we don't tell people to break the law, and we don't give that kind of advice. But we do tell them, you know, if you have violated a law, if you violated the law like your domestic assault or something like that, then we say you may be picked up. You're running a big risk with regard to immigration law because even in the old days that was considered an aggravated felony and it was bad. You know, when he talks about bad hombres, then the president might be thinking like that. But we tell them, you know, until this settles down – start looking around at your family and try to figure out what plan B is going to be. And I know that's upsetting to a lot of people, but I mean, if you need to set up a guardianship for your U.S. citizen children, then maybe now's the time to do it.
And I think we also have to be realistic. It is fiscally impossible to deport 11 to 12 million people. Today, national action is happening across the country to do a day without an immigrant to show the impact that it would have on our economy, on our schools, on our businesses if immigrants were gone. We've got over 250 businesses in Charlotte alone that are closing today to show solidarity and to show the impact that getting rid of all immigrants would have on our country.
And I think if they actually implement some of these proposals that Trump has against business immigration, then you'll actually see the other part of American society come out and say, wait a second. Immigration law is broken. The enforcement of immigration law is broken, and the non-immigrant work visas seems to be broken, according to what the Trump people are saying. I think we're going to see a lot of mess coming down when you put them all together.
We've had a lot of discussions, you and I, about this on this program, and we've had other discussions in which you were not part of about this, and Atenas, this is her first time here. So because this is so divisive and because people are so – they're lined up on one side or the other with people whose hearts break at the thought of families being split up, particularly where children who were born and raised here by undocumented immigrants – face the possibility of either having to go with their parents to a country they have no connection to and sometimes don't even speak the language that well, or watching their parents be carted off and they have to fend for themselves in this country. No one wants that to happen. I don't think even the hardest heart wants that to happen. But nonetheless, the law is the law. And there are consequences for breaking the law. So how is this different from facing the consequences of maybe you go out and you commit an armed robbery because you're trying to feed your family and suddenly you end up in prison and your kids are out on the street? How is this different? Explain that to me.
Well, first of all, most immigration violations are civil violations.
No, what I'm saying is
criminal.
You broke the law to come here. Mm-hmm. So now there are consequences, according to President Bush, for doing that. How is this different from breaking any other law?
President Trump.
Yes, President Trump. What did I say?
President Bush.
I'm so gosh.
You know,
time warp.
The whole idea of not prosecuting everybody for breaking the law isn't something that's unique to immigration. Prosecutorial discretion is actually something that comes from the criminal side of things, where prosecutors acknowledge that they cannot convict or prosecute everyone. Mm. And it's the same thing here. You just have to weigh the options, weigh what makes sense and what does not make sense given the goals. Now, President Trump's goal seems to be to get rid of all immigrants and to make the United States a non-welcoming country. And under those goals, maybe it's different.
Now, where there are situations where the children were born here and are American citizens by right of birth and have known nothing but the United States, is there any legal provision for their parents to be able to stay here?
Well,
if they are discovered and threatened with deportation.
There's lots of gray areas in the law, but I mean, if there's cancellation of removal, there's suspension of deportation, there's some relief, but there's not enough relief. And so you come back to the same point that we've talked about a few times in the past, which is the law's broken. Just because coming here illegally or being here without status is a federal violation, federal crime, that doesn't mean that we have to enforce that and make people leave because of that. We don't really enforce jaywalking rules in Charlotte. I mean, these are civil violations. People think it's a horrible thing, but then you come down to what's the economic impact on North Carolina and South Carolina if you were to enforce all of this and get rid of everybody that's done even minor violations.
Of these 250 businesses that are shutting down today, mm-hmm. and just to show support and solidarity for immigrants, what kinds of businesses are they? I know there's a major food store that's involved mm-hmm. in this.
Right, Compare Foods, mm-hmm. which isn't just in Charlotte or North Carolina. There's also a lot of Latino restaurants, grocery stores, bakeries. I believe there are also some non-Latino businesses that are shutting down. But aside from those, there's also the businesses that are being affected because their workers aren't showing up and they are not able to operate.
Right. I actually heard from a friend this morning that the place they go for breakfast up in Davidson was serving only coffee this morning because the kitchen help did not come to work.
Lawn services come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Builders, home builders come to
mind. The construction industry is huge. Who builds your homes? Who builds all our buildings?
You have said that there's no indication that things are going back to normal, and there's the fear that this is the new normal. What then? I have 10 seconds. What then?
We've got to educate. We've got to protect. We have to show our immigrants that they are welcome.
Athena Spirola with the Immigration Integration Center and the Latin American Coalition, Alan Gordon with Alan Gordon Immigration Law, and David Borax from WFAE News.